Hello, it's Mike Harbath with this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from my home office in Prior Lake, Minnesota, here with my partner, Revenue Rocket, Ryan Barnett.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, morning, Ryan. Today we're going to talk about what to expect as a seller if you're going to be selling your business and how to navigate this this crazy thing called mergers and acquisitions for if you're an IT services company. Ryan, over to you.
Yeah, so we work with about half of our work is on the buy side. And so we're helping companies go out and find the best kind of companies out there to acquire and to grow their business and to strategically make the right decisions to grow their business quickly. And we also work about the other half of our business. Sometimes about 30%, 40% of our business is really around the sell side, in which we're helping sellers really find a home for the company that they've built. And what we've learned throughout the years is that, yes, it is a financial transaction, but it is a large emotional process to put yourself and your company out to market and really find a home for it. So I wanted to talk with you today, Mike, on kind of what you've seen in the emotional process and what should sellers start to expect when they're expecting to sell their business. So with that, I just want to start really on a high level. You know, when a founder's thinking about selling their business, what are some reasons why they should even start the process? I mean, why even consider to a merger and acquisition or a sell side process?
Yeah, so you know, that's a good question. There's different motivations for different sellers. Certainly, you know, most folks, I would say, in the IT services world, start their business and are running it, and you know, most of them think at some point they're going to want to exit and you know, either retire or move on and do something different. They'd like to build some sustainable value into the business prior to doing that, but most of them don't run an active sell side process. I would say mid career. I would say most run one when they're approaching retirement. And so, you know, for folks that do that, they certainly have come to a place in their own mind that it's time for them to sell and move on. But I think many sellers are somewhat opportunistic, and then they get contacted, you know, by a firm like us or some other buyer, and they say, hey, you know, would you like to engage in a conversation to explore the potential exit of or sale of your business? And when you do that, you know, it certainly gets you thinking about, you know, hey, maybe there is some value in joining another firm or kind of merging with another business and playing a bigger role or, you know, being part of something that has maybe a bigger footprint. And I think I always have coached our clients that are selling and those folks that we're approaching to sell to really spend some time in thinking about, you know, what's next for them. Because most acquisitions or mergers can get facilitated much more easily if the seller is clear about what they're going to be doing post-transaction. I've seen many transactions have issues over the years where people struggle, sellers in particular, struggle with their role if they don't have clarity and haven't put enough time into thinking how will this work post-transaction, whether you're staying with the business or whether you're transitioning out of the business. And I certainly would encourage sellers to, you know, give that some thought. You know, as I often say, wave the magic wand. And like, hey, if you sold your business tomorrow, what would I do? What would I do next? What would I like to do? Is there something I'd like to pursue that, you know, maybe now you'd have the time and or money to do? And, you know, certainly give that some soak time and some thought prior to entering into a conversation about selling your business.
Yeah, and I would echo that and add it's helpful to have that documented. You know, why are you selling this business? And it's sometimes difficult if a company is just looking at favorable market conditions and there's a big kind of cash payout at the end. That's hard for as a someone who's helping you sell your company to sell. You know, hey, I just want to pay out. Buyers are looking for more than just a financial transaction. They're looking for something that's going to be better together. So even though financial reasons may be a big reason why you're going to market, it helps to understand why a company will be better together ever before starting the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I think if you've put a lot of time and energy and money, which you inevitably have in building a successful business, you know, it comes time, you know, this, when it comes time to sell, it's a big decision, right? It's a decision that, you know, certainly you have to be mentally prepared to, what I would say, exit that business, and do something else, whatever that something else might be. I mean, we've had clients that have gone on to start, you know, all kinds of interesting businesses. One in particular started a Taekwondo studio, you know, another started a restaurant, someone else, you know, started a, you know, a boat brokerage. I mean, there's all kinds of things that people pursue, what they might be passionate about outside of, you know, IT services. And they gave that, you know, considerable thought. And I think you also have to be, you know, pretty pragmatic with yourself about how long you want to work and if you'd want to be selling in or selling out. We often use those terms. Selling in is really, hey, I'm going to join this firm that would buy my company. I'm going to play a role, you know, maybe a very significant role, senior role, or maybe a sales role or whatever the role might be. And you need to be focused and happy on that role. A lot of people like to do that. If they want to, you know, make their life a little less complicated. Obviously, growing and running a business, there's a lot to be thought about and done and managed in that effort. And so it is, it's important to note that those types of decisions are, you know, pretty critical to have thought out ahead of time. And certainly, you know, whether you're selling in or selling out is another one of those things that I would consider. If you're selling out, you certainly want to be able to, you know, understand how long you're willing to stick around. Some people want to stick around, you know, a very short period of time, as short as they can. Some want to have a more planned and methodical exit that might take, 3 months or, you know, 6 months or 2 years or whatever it may be. But, you know, selling in and selling out is another consideration for you to take into consideration when you're going to sell.
Sure. And as a seller is preparing to go to market or even making the first decisions, who should they involve in their company in that decision and in the sale process?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. You know, we typically advise sellers to include their staff on a need-to-know basis. And typically the need-to-know folks are senior executives that will be involved with due diligence or partners or, you know, folks that will be able to keep that pending transaction confidential. You know, a deal is never done until it is done. Right. And because of that, oftentimes if you share that you're bringing your firm to market or that you're in negotiations to sell the business, that's an unsettling topic for most employees who are like, well, wait a minute. I don't know who the new buyer might be and maybe they won't want me. And, you know, maybe I should look for a job. And certainly if you have a bunch of staff that are exiting your business, before you sell it, that's going to impact value, and it may even impact the buyer's interest in acquiring your firm at all. So generally, you know, the rule of thumb is it's really a need to know basis. You usually communicate to that team, the rest of the team, the whole team, when you're within a week or two of closing, generally when all of the material negotiations with the buyer are completed, and your documentation is completed and you're just moving towards the closing date. That way you have a high degree of confidence that the deal will close, That's when you want to share with everyone that you're selling, and also introduce the buyers so they can get to know them and understand the merits of the deal. If the team understands the merits of the deal, they're much more likely to move forward with it, and generally will take a bit of a wait and see attitude before they may make decisions to exit or change or do whatever.
Yeah, it's a bit of a lonely road for the founder or the person who owns the shares to do that. So I would say the other part to that is that you do have to have good alignment with your other investors and your other partners within the firm. Whether the CEO might do it alone, in reality, it's going to take the ownership group to sell out or the majority owners to be on the same page to really come to that same decision.
Yep.
And with that, just to transition, so if I'm going to take the role of a seller here and I've decided to sell my business, what are the first things, and let's assume that we're using Revenue Rocket for the transaction to help us through this. What's the first step in the process that I understand is it's going to be really to determine the readiness and goals of the project? What goes into the readiness assessments that we conduct for clients on the sell side?
Yeah, you know, readiness assessment, starts with the valuation, right? You want to know what your fair market value is for your business. I think there's a lot of, noise in the market about how to value an IT services business. A lot of people talk about multiples of EBITDA or multiples of certain classes of revenue, like reoccurring revenue or project revenue or reseller or cloud revenue. All these models are what we loosely call kind of spreadsheet math or back of the napkin type models. There ultimately is only one way to determine value. And we get to as close as we can to approximate that through a very a mature valuation approach that we've vetted hundreds of times with companies around the world where ultimately transactions occur. But that's when you have a willing buyer and a willing seller come together on a price. That's what sets value, actual value. We sort of have an estimate for that through the model that we've created to do value and look at the firm's value. And part of readiness has to be that you would be ready to sell for that price point. That's kind of a first and foremost thing that should be in the front of your mind. Beyond that, it has to do with, do the synergies of the deal line up? And, we often say that a deal has to align, strategically, culturally, and financially to really create a 1+1=3 scenario. One in which you're better together and can do things together that you can't really do apart. That is a litmus test, particularly for strategy alignment. And strategy, culture, and financial alignment certainly needs to be thought about when you're looking at a buyer. So when you're thinking about readiness, beyond the valuation, you have to be sort of ready to look for that synergy. And you have to be prepared to play a different role or to exit the business, when you do the transaction. And we provide some advice and coaching on, are you selling in or selling out? And if you're selling in, what kind of role would you like to play in a converged organization? And, having knowledge of that and you thinking about that and us thinking about that, we can help certainly make that a reality.
So it sounds like once a valuation is done and I get that back, it sounds like that's a critical point of either moving forward or not. And what advice can you give a seller when they get that valuation? From what I've seen on the opposite end of the table is companies really expect a lot out of their valuation, and when they see the number, it's always a bit of a tricky conversation. What advice can you give to a founder to review that valuation in light of the market and what they might actually get for their firm that keep in mind is their baby, and they think is really the most important asset that they have.
Well, you know, I think, you know, deal terms can vary, right? I mean, they vary a lot. They can be all cash, or they can be all earnout, or somewhere in between. Typically, deals are, you know, 60 to 70% guaranteed in one way, shape, or another, and the rest is some aligned interest variable component. Some people call that an earnout. Some people call that a payout. Some people call that a, you know, seller note. And they have different levels of risk. And I think when you're, you know, looking at synergies, there are certainly, structure plays into is an important consideration in the overall value you will receive. And so I think you have to think a little bit about your risk tolerance and your ability to optimize value and how much risk you might want to take in structuring, in order to optimize value. And some of that has to do with the buyer, and some of that has to do with the potential for, you know, really doing something special together and how much risk you want to take. Oftentimes we hear from sellers that say, well, you know, I'm selling my business, so I don't want to, you know, take much risk. I don't want this, I don't want that. But what they forget is that they're taking 100% of the risk today, right? So if you're running your business and you take 100% of the risk and you don't, you know, you think that the offer is too risky, I think you have to begin to look at, you know, all these components and understand how you're going to off-ramp that risk, even if some of it is over time and requires some sort of performance criteria.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So let's assume that we say yes, we get the valuation back, it looks great, and we say let's do this. The next steps that we typically do is start to figure out an ideal prospect profile and a list of suitors. Now, when you're selling your business, it's not necessarily easy to come up with the perfect buyer. Now, we always have some assumptions, and we think that's typically going to be in the market that you're currently serving. It's currently typically going to be in the geography that you may be serving. And there's size-wise, you know, a company about twice your size is going to be big enough to pull off a deal. In fact, sometimes if you're a $10 million company, a $20 million company is going to fit the bill. We do sometimes get a little bit of pushback from sellers on that, saying, hey, do they have the capital? Well, in reality, if a company is going to do a deal, they want to do as big of a deal as they can. So when we start to look at the process, the best way that you're going to want to look at the finding suitors is to really build the perfect ideal list. And that list can be strategic fits. It could be geographic expansion. It could be perfect technical fits, or it could be a product line extension. It's sometimes hard to find out what the actual buyer may be if you're looking for a strategic fit. Alongside of that, we also look at private equity groups, but typically more the platform companies that the private equity is funding. So we don't like to deal straight with money guys, as they're frankly, you know, typically cheaper. So when we develop a target list, we're going to go to market, finding kind of the best strategic fits that we can. And we do something a little different in that we have our clients approve the target list that they're going after. And Mike, do you have any kind of insight into why we do that for our clients? Why do they go through that approval process?
Yeah, so an approval list, it's critically important that a seller knows who we're contacting on their behalf, right? And I would say this is the same for, you know, really any project, right? It's about communications and it's about expectations management. And I think the seller, as we go to market, you want to be able to say, yes, this would be an ideal buyer, or no, this would not, because of, you know, maybe they're a competitor that's a little too close. Maybe you don't want them knowing that you're in the market. Maybe there's some other specific reason But beyond approving the initial list, there's other gates of qualification that we use that we think are important. And that, you know, and there's, you know, probably four gates that we use to qualify. And then the final gate of qualification with our client who's selling is the notification that a potential buyer wants to sign a non-disclosure. And they certainly can decide to not do that if the relationship with a potential buyer has changed. So as an example of that would be, let's say you initially approve a list, we do the outreach, we determine there's interest, we're moving them through. And since then, you've signed a partnering agreement with that potential company. Well, that partnering agreement may be really valuable to you, and you may not want to let that potential partner know that you're in the market. And so it's an example for you to off-ramp the process even at that point. So being surgical about the approach to the market, approving who a representative such as Revenue Rocket would be contacting on your behalf, even if they're not disclosing your name, is critically important to, you know, maintaining confidentiality in the process.
That makes a lot of sense. When we look through this process, so we create a target list. That's a concurrent effort to what is a fairly arduous process, which is document creation. So meanwhile, a target list is created. We're getting your story ready, and we're trying to figure out kind of the history of the company, your service and product offerings. We're gathering your financial statements. It's a bit of a dig. So we're looking at P&Ls, balance sheets, forecast, receiving reports, payables reports, kind of headcount data. And we compile all those information. All that information really comes down to two really important documents. One is a teaser. And when a seller first looks at their teaser, it can seem a little bit underwhelming because we're trying to get a ton of information on one page, but we're also trying to tell a really good story and keep it anonymous. And having that balance is always a tricky thing to do, but it's what helps us really kind of get to that next gate, which is sending out a teaser and getting an introduction call started, a screening call. So in an ideal world, you're not going to send out a teaser to the entire world. You're going to send a teaser to your strategic companies or strategic targets. And from that, you'll conduct a screening call to understand, you know, do they really have the wherewithal to pull off a deal? Sellers, you should really not expect to divulge yourself at this point. It should be a fairly high level conversation in understanding strategic fit and financial capability to get a deal done. But if that's determined, we typically process NDAs between two companies. And from there, send over what we'd put together, which is a confidential information memorandum. So unlike the teaser that's one page, this is going to be typically a 15 to 20 page report that really looks at the details, the history, service lines, the people in the organizations, all the way down to benefit plans. As a seller, it really helps to have all of those financial documents in line before you start this process. If you have everything going, it makes the whole document creation a lot easier. But nevertheless, there's going to be a lot of back and forth with whoever you choose to help bring you to market in that document creation. Once we've got someone signed under an NDA and we've been able to send them over that confidential information memorandum, we then move into a introduction call. Mike, you know, what's a typical introduction call look like, and what should a seller expect to disclose in that introduction call?
Yeah, so an introduction call, you know, that's just getting to know each other, right? The seller getting to know the buyer and vice versa. Typically, we recommend a presentation be done about your business, and we ask a buyer to do the same to further facilitate the dialogue around what a strategic connection could look like. Keep in mind that at this point they've been, you know, fully qualified and have signed an NDA, but it it really is about, you know, what is your business about? What is some of your customer and employee care philosophies? You know, how do you market the business? Maybe an overview, high level overview of the financial performance of the business, to enable a buyer to ask questions and vice versa. The buyer's presentation certainly will allow you as a seller to ask questions about the same topics to see and explore whether there's a synergy, enough of a synergy to go, you know, facilitate a deal. It's really about, is there some there, if you will, or not? Now, you'll find most of the time that you will see that there is some there. And the primary reason that is because, you know, you should by now have taken a pretty deep dive on qualification. You know, your advisor, in this case, if it's us, has taken a pretty deep dive on qualification of that potential buyer. For, as I mentioned before, strategy, culture, and financial fit, right? So when you get to this validation step or meeting them, you know, it's just further understanding their business and validation of that business to constitute and justify further communications or diligence to be put forth as you move down the road with this particular buyer.
And how much information should someone give out, Mike? So if a buyer's asking for a particular information, how much should the seller disclose? This is pre a letter of intent.
Yeah, you know, I think, technically it's covered under the non-disclosure. So if it's disclosed, it's considered covered under the non-disclosure. We generally recommend that companies at this relatively early stage may blind customer information. Certainly most of the time you would also blind employee information, maybe refer to them only by first name, or, you know, certainly do not feel the need to have to disclose everything on the first call. We think certainly all that information will need to be disclosed once you get to a deal structure, which would be post letter of intent. But early on, you can just refer to customers by, a number or some sort of other attribute or handle as you're explaining the business.
Yeah, and I would say the other piece of advice there is that the reason why we're taking a gated approach to the sale. So the teaser is only going to get enough information to secure the NDA. And that confidential information memorandum is really almost a secondary teaser to get the introduction. And the introduction should be a teaser to really kind of due diligence review, which ultimately leads to an offer. So we're trying to minimize the requests and pulls, and we're trying to kind of pull together the best story for the best ideal offer at the best time. And speaking of that, and we're looking at target lists and we're looking at introduction calls, Mike, how many suitors should a seller expect in this process? Do you see things like auctions, or do you see things like kind of calls for indication of intent? What expectations should a seller have when it takes to get a deal done?
Well, I often say that it just takes one potential buyer. Right. I think everybody would love to have, people clamoring to buy your business. But as a matter of course, auctions create sort of a challenging, scenario in that, they're usually the folks that participate in auctions are usually financial buyers. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in a case of a financial buyer, they usually are not looking for this, strategic, high degree of strategic synergies. They say they are, but they're really driven much more by a financial sort of model. And I think that, that that true strategic buyer is going to look for aligned interest and is going to look to a deal structure where everybody wins. And I'm not saying that financial buyers necessarily don't, but they tend to be a little more transactional in their approach to the deal. And it's not, you know, atypical that a financial buyer may also try to, you know, beat you down or retrade the deal after a letter of intent is in place. Because they're going to, you know, do a deep dive critique of your EBITDA, because their models are very much about multiples of EBITDA, and less about, you know, focused on, one plus one equals three per se. So I would just, you know, see that auctions oftentimes we see are ones that have buyers that may not be folks that you would consider to be a strong fit to acquire. So now, doesn't mean that you may not have multiple offers from strategic buyers, folks that come together and coalesce at a similar time. And we see more than any time right now, multiple buyers for almost every transaction. I wouldn't say, you know, every transaction, but almost every transaction. And those multiple buyers have different ways of thinking about value. So it's not really like an auction, but you can leverage those multiple buyers, sort of against, if you will, one another to, optimize the value of your business in a sale. And we think that that works just fine, even though it's not technically an auction.
That makes sense. So if we got a suitors at the table or a suitor and suitors at the table, the next step is typically receiving a letter of intent. And that letter of intent, what should a seller look for in a letter of intent? I mean, is it a long document? What's included in it? Kind of what's in that LOI?
Yeah. So you have to keep in mind that a letter of intent is like a handshake agreement. It is a non-binding agreement. And oftentimes people get, you know, mired down in the weeds and say, hey, we're really looking for a document that outlines every potential scenario for how this deal is going to work and how it's going to get paid. It's not really that. What it is, it's simply a high level outline that says, you know, if you agree to this, you're going to agree to a particular straw man deal structure that will be vetted in due diligence. But more importantly, you're agreeing to a no-shop. Most buyers insist on a no-shop clause in their letter of intent. And the reason they do that is because they're going to incur a lot of expense, just as you are as a seller, as you move through this process. And you don't want to incur that expense and then have some other buyer come in and outbid you, per se, and, you know, buy that company out from under you. So most letters of intent, you know, the binding provisions that need to be understood and honored have to do with confidentiality and what we call the no-shop clause. But the rest of the terms of that letter of intent should, you know, broadly outline the terms of the agreement. But the details and the legally binding document will be what's called the definitive agreement or the purchase agreement. And that's where, you know, you want your lawyer and your M&A advisor to pay very close attention, because that's ultimately the legal binding agreement.
Right, right. So after the letter of intent goes in place, kind of the cycles that a seller is going to go through next are really the due diligence from the buyer. So buyers will send over a due diligence list, and that really varies from target to target. What we've seen, and there's some standards there, and expect to see the same P&Ls and balance sheets that that we started the process with. So that should be ready to go. There's going to be a legal review, a financial review, and to your point, Mike, the drafting of the definitive agreements. Meanwhile, the seller should also be thinking, you know, let's assume this deal is going to get done, and begin post merger integration, process planning. So the definitive agreements will take a bit to get through. Mike, what's the typical time frame that, you know, once an LOI is signed to deal execution. What should someone expect?
Well, we often say it's about a 90-day process, and certainly it can be shorter or it can be longer. It depends a lot on, frankly, how deep the legal counsel wants to go, right, on either side of the deal. If legal counsel on a particular side of the deal is wanting to negotiate every, you know, nuance of agreement, every small portion of the agreement, it can take a long time. We've seen those negotiations take, you know, 4, 5, 6 months sometimes. And we just think that, you know, that is untenable in our opinion. We try to not have that occur. But what I would tell you happens, you know, it's the old 80-20 rule. What happens 80% of the time? The deals get done in about 90 days from the time you sign a letter of intent to the time you close. And that time is spent predominantly in working with your lawyer and responding to a buyer's, the terms they put into the definitive agreement. And ultimately, you know, making decisions on the negotiations that surround the definitive agreement, but also the business terms that further have to get fleshed out for which legal has to document into the DA.
Sure. So if a letter of intent is the high level plan, so if we intend to acquire a company for cash and it's going to close at this date, the definitive agreement goes much deeper. And Mike, you've mentioned there's literally hundreds of items to negotiate. I would say one piece of advice that we give is just kind of buckle in, because there's going to be a lot of turns and a lot of discussions. So the LOI is high, but the definitive agreement is in the dirt, and that's eventually how both the buyers and sellers make the most out of this arrangement.
Absolutely.
Just got 1 minute left here with you, Mike. I'm just curious, and feel free to disclose this, but what should a seller expect as far as fees? I mean, how do you pay for this thing? And what does a typical structure look like in going through a deal?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, most credible M&A advisors charge a retainer plus a success fee. I say credible because there's many advisors that try to position their advice to you on a contingent basis, on, hey, we're contingent upon us, doing a deal, right? Kind of a success fee only type arrangement. And I would argue that the challenge with that arrangement is that most of these guys that agree to do contingencies are very thinly capitalized companies that may just be one individual trying to do all of the roles that are needed to help you close your transaction, or a handful of people in the company. That's a very challenging scenario to be in, because it takes many, many roles to successfully do one of these transactions. We say oftentimes it's about 10 discrete roles. And for one person to wear 10 hats and effectively do it, and then, you know, try to get that deal as well as other deals done on a contingency, we just don't think makes sense. So credible M&A advisors charge a retainer plus a success fee. Those retainers range typically from upfront type retainers, can be, 50 to 75,000 to pay as you go retainers. We happen to use a pay as you go model, and there's many firms that do. We think that's better for the client because, it allows, the advisor has to earn their keep every day. Otherwise they're, you're not going to pay them. You're going to cancel a contract. So, those monthly retainers can range from about $5,000 to $10,000 usually. And then the success fees, most advisors index success fees on the sale price of the business if you're selling. And they, use a sliding scale associated with how successful or, frankly, they're not in negotiating a premium in the sale of your business. And you know, and those can range in, they range probably from 2 to 4% is the best way to think about it. They tend to be a higher percentage for small firms and a lower percentage for larger companies.
Great. That makes sense. Well, Mike, I appreciate all the insight on this process and hope that some founders, when they're going through it, can benefit from it as well. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan. And with that, we'll tie a ribbon on this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. We look forward to talking with you guys and having you listen next week as we approach other topics relevant to growing and successfully acquiring or selling your IT services business. Take care.